Umsuk never bothered to lock his lab, you see.
Why was it that you never met Wing 027 again?
One humid afternoon, 3 weeks after my arrival at Temo-san, a knock on the door distracted Umsuk from his Facescaper catalog. Unexpected visitors were rare, as I have said. Umsuk said, "Enter," and hid his catalog under practical genomics. My postgrad rarely glanced at his texts, unlike me. A wiry student poked the door open with his toe. "Boom boom," he called my postgrad. Umsuk sprang to attention, sat down, then slouched. "Hey, hey, Ju," he faked a casual manner. "What's up?" The visitor was just passing to say hi, he claimed, but he accepted the offered chair. I learned Heju Im was Boomsook's ex-classmate, but had been headhunted by Temo-san's unanimity faculty. Boomsook told me to prepare tea while they discussed topics of no importance. As I served the drink, Heju Im mentioned,
"You'll know about your friend Min Sik's appalling afternoon by now."
Boomsook denied Min Sik was a friend necessarily, then asked why his afternoon was appalling. "His specimen, Wing 027, was burnt to bacon." Min Sik had mistaken a minus for a plus on the label of a bottle of petroalkali. My own postgrad smirked, giggled, snorted, hysterical, and laughed. Heju then did an unusual action. He looked at me.
"Why is that unusual?"
"Purebloods see us often, but look at us rarely." Much later, Heju admitted he was curious about my response. Boomsuk noticed nothing. He speculated about compensation claims by the corp sponsoring Min Sik's research. In his own solo research, Boomsuk gloated, no one cared if an experimental fabricant or two got dropped along the path of scientific enlightenment.
"Did you feel... well, what did you feel? Resentment? Grief?"
"Fury." I retreated to the anteroom because something about Heju Im made me cautious. But I had never felt such fury. Una 939 was worth 20 Boomsooks, and Wing 027 worth 20 Min 6 by any measure. Because of an exec's carelessness, my only friend on Mount Temo-san was dead, and Boomsook viewed this murder as humorous. But fury forges will. That day was the first step to my declarations, to this prison cube, and to the lighthouse in a few hours.
"What happened to you over summer recess?"
Boomsook should have deposited me in a holding dorm room, but my postgrad was so eager to go hunt fabricant elk on Hokkaido in eastern Korea that he forgot to do so, or assumed a lesser strata drone would do it for him. So one summer morning I woke in a wholly deserted building. No echoes from well-trafficked corridors, no time bell, no announcements. Even air cons were turned off. From the roof, the conurb fumed and trafficked as usual, and swarming arrows left vapor streaks across the sky. But the campus was empty of students. Its Ford parks were semi-vacant. Builders were resurfacing the oval square in the hot sun. I checked the Sony's calendar and learned today was the beginning of recess. I bolted the lab's door and hid myself in the anteroom.
"So you never set foot outside Boomsook's lab in 5 weeks? Not once?"
"Not once. I dreaded separation from my Sony, you see. A security guard tested the lab door every ninth night. Sometimes I heard Gil Soo-noon in the adjacent lab. Otherwise, nothing. I kept the blind lowered and the solars off at night. I had enough soap to last the duration."
"But that's 50 days of unbroken solitary confinement."
50 glorious days, archivist. My mind traveled the length, breadth, and depth of our culture. I devoured the 12 seminals, Zhang Il's 7 dialects, Prime Chairman's founding of Nia Socopros, Admiral Yang's history of the skirmishes. You know the list. Indices in an uncensored commentaries led me to pre-skirmish thinkers. The library refused many downloads, of course, but I succeeded with 2 optimists translated from the late English, Orwell and Huxley, and Washington's satires on democracy.
"And you were still Boomsook's thesis specimen, putatively, when he returned for the second semester?"
"Yes. My first autumn arrived. I made a secret collection of the flame-colored leaves that drifted on the faculty roof. Autumn itself aged, and my leaves lost their colors. Nights became icy, then even daylight hours frosted up. Bumsuk dozed on the heated ondule most afternoons, watching 3D. He had lost a lot of dollars in dubious investments over the summer, and since his father was refusing to pay his debts, my postgrad was prone to fits of temper. My only defense against these tantrums was to act void.
Did it snow?
Ah, yes, snow. The first snows fell very late last year, not until 12th month. I sensed it before I woke in the semi-dark. Snowflakes haloed the New Year fairies decorating the courtyard windows. Entrancing, archivist. Entrancing. Undergrowth beneath the neglected statue in the courtyard drooped under the weight of snow, and the statue itself assumed a comic majesty. I could watch the snow fall from my previous prison cube, and I miss it here. Snow is bruised lilac in half-light. Such pure solace.
You speak like an aesthete sometimes, Sanmi.
Perhaps those deprived of beauty perceive it most instinctively.
So it must be around now that Dr. Meffy enters the story.
Yes, Sextet Eve. It was snowing that night, too. Bumsuk, Minsik, and Fang burst in at hour 20 approx. Talks flushed, ice on their Nikes. I was in the anteroom and barely had time to hide my Sony. I remember I was reading Plato's Republic. Bumsuk wore a mortarboard hat, and Minsik hugged a basket of mint-scented orchids as big as himself. He threw them at me, saying, "Petals for Spoony, Spawny, Sonmi, whatever its name is." Fang rifled the cupboard where Bumsuk kept his soju and tossed three bottles over his shoulder, complaining that the brands were all dog piss. Minsik caught two, but a third smashed on the floor, triggering relapses of laughter. "Clean it up, Cinderella!" Bumsuk clapped his hands at me, then pacified Fang by saying he'd open a bottle of the best stuff since Sextet recess came only once a year. By the time I had swept up every glass shard, Minsik had found a porn/Disney on 3D. They watched it with expert relish, bickering over its merits and realism, and drinking the fine soju. Their drunkenness had a recklessness that night, especially Fang's. I retreated to the anteroom from where I heard Gil Soo Noon at the lab door, asking the revelers to be quieter. I spied. Minsik mocked Gil Soo's glasses, asking why his family couldn't find the dollars to correct his myopia. Bumsuk told Gil Soo to crawl up his own cock if he wanted peace and quiet when the civilized world was celebrating Sextet. When he had stopped laughing, Fang spoke about getting his father to order a tax inspection on the Noon clan. Gil Soo Noon fumed in the doorway until the three execs pelted him away with plums and further derision.
Fang seems to have been the ringleader.
He was, yes. He chiseled open the fault lines in the others' personalities. Doubtless, he is currently practicing law in one of the 12 capitals with great success. That night he focused on riling Bumsuk by wagging the soju bottle at the Kodak of the dead snow leopard and asking how dopey the prey were, genomed down for the tourists. Bumsuk's pride was inflamed. The only animals he hunted, he retorted, were those with viciousness genomed up. He and his brother had stalked the snow leopard for hours in Kathmandu Valley, before the cornered animal leapt for his brother's throat. Bumsuk had a single shot. The bolt entered the beast's eye in mid-air. Hearing this, Fang and Minsik faked awe for a moment, then collapsed in raucous laughter. Minsik thumped the floor, saying, "You are so full of shit, Kim." Fang peered closer at the Kodak and remarked that it was poorly digied. Bumsuk inked a face on a synthetic melon, solemnly wrote Fang on its brow, and balanced the fruit on a stack of journals by the door. He took his crossbow from his desk, walked to the far-end window, and took aim. Fang protested, "No, no, 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 no," and objected that a melon would not rip the marksman's throat out if he missed. There was no pressure to make a clean hit. Fang then beckoned me over to stand by the door. I saw his intention, but Fang interrupted my appeal, warning that if I did not obey him,
he would put Min Sik in charge of my soap. Min Sik's grin wilted. Fang sank his nails into my arm, led me over, put the mortarboard hat on my head, and placed the melon on the hat. "So, Boom Sook," he teased. "Reckon you're such a hot shit marksman now?" Boom Sook's relationship with Fang was based on rivalry and loathing. He raised his crossbow. I asked my postgrad to please stop. Boom Sook ordered me not to move a muscle. The bolt's steel tip glinted. Dying in one of these boys' dares would be futile and stupid, but fabricants cannot dictate even the terms of their deaths. A twang and an air whoosh later, the crossbolt crisped into melon pulp. The fruit rolled off the hat. Min Sik applauded warmly, hoping to thaw the situation. I was awash with relief. However, Fang sniffed. You hardly need laser guidance to hit a huge melon. Anyway, look, he held the melon's remains. You only just clipped it. Surely a mango is a worthier target for a hunter of your stature. Boom Sook held out his crossbow to Fang, daring him to match his own skill. Hit the mango from 15 paces. Done, Fang took the crossbow. I protested despairingly, but Boom Sook told me to shut up. He drew an eye on the mango. Fang counted his paces and loaded the bolt. Min Sik warned his friends that the paperwork on a dead experimental specimen was hell. They ignored him. Fang aimed for a long time. His hand trembled slightly. Suddenly the mango exploded and juiced the walls. My doubt that my ordeal was over was well-founded. Fang blew on the crossbow. Melon at 30 paces, mango at 15. I'll raise you a plum at 10. He noted a plum was still bigger than a snow leopard's eye, but added that if Boom Sook wanted to admit he was indeed, as Min Sik had said, full of shit, and declined the challenge, they would consider the sorry chapter closed for a whole 10 minutes. Boom Sook just balanced the plum on my head, gravely, and ordered me to hold very, very still. He counted his 10 steps, turned, loaded, and took aim. I guessed I had a 50% chance of being dead in 15 seconds. Gil Su banged on the door again. Go away, I thought at him. No distractions now. Boom Sook's jaw twitched as he cranked back the bow. The banging on the door grew more insistent, just centimeters from my head. Fang blasted obscenities about Gil Su's genitals and his mother. Boom Sook's knuckles whitened on his crossbow. My head was whip-cracked around. Pain sank teeth into my ear. I was aware of the door flying open behind me, then of expressions of doom on my tormentors' faces. Lastly, I noticed an older man in the doorway, snow in his beard, out of breath, and thunderously angry.
Boardman Meffy?
Yes, but let us be thorough. Unanimity Professor, architect of the American Boat People Solution, holder of a Neo-Socopris Medal for Eminence, monographist on Tufu and Li Po, Douche Boardman Aloy Meffy. I paid him little notice at that time, however. Liquid trickled down my neck and spine. When I dabbed my ear, pain seemed to electrocute the left side of my body. My fingers came away shiny and scarlet. Boom Sook's voice wobbled. Boardman, we... No help was offered from Fang or Min Sik. The boardman pressed a crisp silk handkerchief against my ear and told me to keep the pressure steady. He took a handsoni from an inner pocket. Mr. Cheng, he spoke into it. First aid, hurry, please. Now I recognized the sleepy passenger who had accompanied me from Chongmyo Plaza 8 months before. Next, my rescuer stared at the postgrads. They dared not meet his gaze. Well, gentlemen, we have made a very ominous start to the Year of the Snake. Min Sik and Fang would be notified by the disciplinary board of major debits, he promised, and dismissed them. Both bowed and hurried out. Min Sik left his cloak steaming on the andouille but did not return. Boom Sook looked inconsolable. Boardman Meffy let the postgrad suffer for some seconds before asking, "Are you planning to shoot at me with that thing, too?" Boom Sook Kim dropped the crossbow as if it were superheated. The boardman looked around the messy lab, sniffing at the neck of the soju bottle.
The octopoid rapin on 3D distracted him. Boomsook fumbled with the Remo, dropped it, picked it up, pressed stop, aimed it the right way, pressed stop. Boardman Meffy spoke finally. He was now ready to hear Boomsook's explanation of why he was using his faculty's experimental fabricant for crossbow practice.
Yes, I'm curious to hear that too.
Boomsook tried everything. He was inexcusably drunk for Sextet Eve. He had misprioritized, ignored stress symptoms, chosen friends unwisely, gotten overzealous while disciplining his specimen. It was all Fang's fault. Then even he realized he had better shut up and wait for the axe to fall. Mr. Cheng arrived with a medicube, sprayed my ear, dabbed coag, applied a patch, and gave me my first friendly word since Wing 027. Boomsook asked if my ear would heal. Boardman Meffy's abrupt answer was that it was none of Boomsook's business, as his doctorate was terminated. The ex-post-grad blanked and whitened as he saw his future slide down strata. Mr. Cheng held my hand and informed me my earlobe was torn off, but promised a medic would replace it in the morning. I was too afraid of Boomsook's recriminations to worry about my ear, but Mr. Cheng added we would now leave with Boardman Meffy for my new quarters.
That must have been very welcome news.
Yes, except for the loss of my Sony. How could I bring that along? No feasible plan came to mind. I just nodded, hoping I could retrieve it during sextet recess. The spiral stairs took up my attention. Descents are more hazardous than ascents. In the lobby, Mr. Chang produced a hooded cloak for me and a pair of ice Nikes. The boardman complimented Mr. Chang on the latter's choice of zebra skin design. Mr. Chang answered, zebra skin was de rigueur in Lhasa's chicest streets this season.
What reason did the boardman give you for your timely rescue?
None as yet. He told me I was being transferred to the Unanimity faculty on the western lip of campus, and apologized for letting those three toxed exec tapeworms play games with my life. The weather had prevented a timelier intervention. I forget what well-oriented, humble reply I gave. The campus cloisters were festive with Sextet Eve crowds. Mr. Cheng taught me to shuffle through granular ice to gain traction. Snowflakes settled on my eyelashes and nostrils. Snowball fights ceased as Professor Meffy approached. Combatants bowed. The sense of anonymity afforded by my hood was delicious. Passing through cloisters, I heard music. Not Advi or pop song, but naked, echoing waves of music.
A choir, Boardman Meffy told me.
Corpocratic sapiens can be callous, petty, and malign, he said. But higher things, too, thank Chairman. We listened for a minute. Looking up, I felt as if I were rushing upward. Two enforcers guarding the Unanimity faculty saluted and took our damp cloaks. This building's interior was as opulent as the psychogenomics faculty had been Spartan. Carpeted corridors were lined with Iljongian mirrors, urns of the Kings of Scylla, 3Ds of Unanimity notables. The elevator had a chandelier. Its voice recited corpocratic catechisms, but Boardman Meffy told it to shut up, and to my surprise, it did. Once again, Mr. Chang held me steady as the elevator sped, then slowed. We exited into a spacious, sunken apartment from an upstrata lifestyle ad-V. A 3D fire danced in the central hearth, surrounded by hovering maglev furniture. Glass walls afforded a dizzying view of the Connor by night, obscured by the haze bright snowfall. Paintings took up the inner walls. I asked Meffy if this was his office.
My office is one story up, he replied. These are your quarters.
Before I could even express surprise, Mr. Cheng suggested I invite my distinguished guest to sit down. I begged Boardman Meffy's pardon. I had never had a guest before, and my manners lacked polish. The maglev sofa swung under the distinguished man's weight. His daughter-in-law, he said, had redesigned my quarters with me in mind. The Rothko canvases, she hoped, I would find meditative. Molecule true original originals, he assured me. I approved. Rothko paints how the blind see.
A bewildering evening. Crossbolts one moment, art history the next.
Certainly. Next, the professor apologized for failing to recognize the extent of my ascension on our first meeting. I assumed you were yet another semi-ascended experiment, doomed to mental disintegration in a week or two. If memory serves, I even dozed off. Mr. Cheng, did I? The truth now. From his post by the elevator, Mr. Cheng recalled that his master had rested his eyes during the journey. Boardman Meffy smiled at his chauffeur's tact. You're more than likely wondering what you did to bring yourself to my attention, Sonmi 451. His question was a handshake. Come out, I know you're in there. Or I feared a trap. Still with a server's wariness of acting too pureblood, I feigned polite incomprehension. Meffy's expression of complicity told me he understood. Tamosan University, he said, generates 2 million-plus library download requests per semester. The vast majority are course texts and related articles. The remainder relate to anything from real estate to stock prices, sports Fords to Steinways, yoga to caged birds. The point is, Sonmi, it takes a reader of truly eclectic habits for my friends the librarians to bother alerting me. The professor switched on his hand, Sony, and read from my own list of download requests. 6th month, 18th, Epic of Gilgamesh. 7th month, 2nd, Iranio Funis's Remembrances. 9th month, 1st, Gibbon's Decline and Fall. Meffy, bathed in mauve Sony glow, looked proud. Here we go. 10th month, 11th, a brazen as you please cross search for references to that cancer in our beloved body corporocratic. Union. Speaking as a unanimity man, such a, could I call it lust, for creeds of other worlds alerts us to the presence of an inner emigre. It is idiomatic in my field that such emigres make the finest unanimity agents. I knew we had to meet. He then explained how he had identified the Sony's inquisitive owner as Nun Hel Kwan, a geothermist from blizzard-prone Ansong, who had died 2 winters before in a skiing accident. Boardman Meffy assigned a gifted graduate the old-fashioned detective's task of tracking the thief. E-Wave surveillance located the Sony in Boom-Suk Kim's lab. Imagining Boom-Suk reading Wittgenstein defied all credulity, however, so Meffy's trusted student had implanted a micro-eye in every Sony in the room during curfew 6 weeks ago. Next day we found our dissident Manke was no pureblood, but apparently science's first stabilized ascendant and sister server of the notorious Yuna 939. My work, Sonmi 451, can be taxing and hazardous, but dull? Never. Denial was plainly pointless. Indeed, Boardman Meffy was no CRE. In a way, my discovery was a relief. Many criminals say the same. I sat and listened to his account of the interdepartmental squabbles that broke out when he reported his findings. Old-school corporocrats wanted me euthanized as a deviant. Psychogenomicists wanted me to undergo cerebral vivisection. Marketing wanted me to go public and claim me as Tamosan University's own experimental breakthrough. Obviously, none of them got their way. No. Unanimity won a stopgap compromise. I could continue studying in my illusory free will until a consensus of opinion could be reached. Boomsuk's crossbow, however, forced unanimity's hand.
And what did Boardman Meffy intend to do with you now?
Frame a new compromise between those interests competing for a slice of me, then enforce it. Billions of research dollars had been spent in corp labs unsuccessfully to achieve what simply I was, what I am. A stable, ascended fabricant. To keep the genomicists happy, an array of vetted scientists would conduct cross-disciplinary tests on me. Meffy, dipping his hands into the heart of the 3D flames, promised these tests would not be onerous or painful, or exceed 3 hours per day, 5 days out of 10. To win over the Tamosan board, research access would be auctioned. I would raise big dollars for my masters.
Did Sonmi 451's interests enter this simultaneous equation?
To a degree, yes.
Temo-san University would enroll me as a foundation student. I would also have a soul implanted in my collar so I could come and go on campus as I pleased. Boardman Mephi even promised to mentor me when he was on campus. He withdrew his hand from the fire and inspected his fingers. All light, no heat. Youngsters nowadays wouldn't know a real flame if their Nikes were set alight. He told me to call him Professor instead of Sir.
One thing I can't work out. If Boomsook Kim was such a buffoon, how had he attained this holy grail of psychogenomics, stable ascension?
Later I asked Hae-Joo Im the same question. His explanation ran, Boomsook's thesis jockey sourced his supply of psychogenomics theses from an obscure tech institute in Baikal. The original author of my ex-postgrad's work was a production zone immigrant named Yusof Suleiman. Extremists were killing genomicists in Siberia at that time, and Suleiman and three of his professors were blown up by a car bomb. Baikal being Baikal, Suleiman's research languished in obscurity for 10 years, until it was sold on. The agent liaised with contacts at Papasan Corp to in-stream Suleiman's ascension neuroformula to our soap. Una 939 was the prime specimen. I was a modified backup. If all that sounds unlikely, Hae-Joo added, I should remember that most of science's holy grails are discovered by accident, in unexpected places.
And all the while Boomsook Kim was blissfully unaware of the furor his plagiarized PhD was causing.
Only an obdurate fool who never squeezed a pipette could remain unaware. But yes, Boomsook Kim was such a fool. Maybe that too was no accident.
How did you find your new regime in the unanimity faculty? How was it as a fabricant actually attending lectures?
As I was moved on Sextet Eve, I had 6 quiet days before the new regime began in earnest. I walked around the icy campus only once. I am genomed to be comfortable in hot eateries, and exposure to the Han Valley winter on Mount Tamosan burned my skin and lungs. On New Year's Day, I awoke from curfew to discover 2 gifts— the battered old Sony Wing 027 had given me, and a star for my collar, my 3rd. I thought of my sisters, my ex-sisters, throughout Neosokopros enjoying starring ceremonies. I wondered if I would one day depart for exaltation, my investment repaid. How I wished Una 939 could attend my first lecture on second day with me. I still miss her.
What was your first lecture?
Swanti's biomathematics. However, its real lesson was humiliation. I walked to the lecture hall across dirty slush, hooded and unnoticed. But when I took off my cloak in the corridor, my somni features provoked surprise, then unease. In the lecture hall, my entry detonated resentful silence. It didn't last. "Oi," a boy called. "One hot ginseng, 2 dog burgers. And the entire theater laughed. I am not genomed to blush, but my pulse rose. I took a seat in the 2nd row occupied by girls. Their leader had emeralded teeth. "This is our row," she said. "Go to the back. You stink of mayo." I obeyed meekly. A paper dart hit my face. "We don't vend burgers in your dinery, fabricant," someone called. "Why are you taking up space in our lecture?"
I was about to leave when spidery Dr. Schwan tripped onto the stage and dropped her notes. I did my best to concentrate on the lecture that followed, but after a while Dr. Schwan's eyes roamed her audience, saw me. She stopped mid-sentence. The audience, laughing, realized why. Dr. Schwan forced herself to continue. I forced myself to stay, but lacked the courage to ask questions at the end. Outside I endured a barrage of aggressive snideries.
Did Professor Mephi know about the students' unfriendliness?
I think so. At our seminar, the professor asked if my lecture had been fruitful. I chose the word informative and asked why purebloods despised me so. He replied,
"What if the differences between social strata stem not from genomics or inherent excellence, or even dollars, but merely differences in knowledge? Would this not mean the whole pyramid is built on shifting sands?"
I speculated such a suggestion could be seen as a serious deviancy. Methy seemed delighted. Try this for deviancy. Fabricants are mirrors held up to pureblood's consciences. What purebloods see reflected there sickens them, so they blame you for holding up the mirror.
I hid my shock by asking when purebloods might blame themselves.
Mephi replied, history suggests not until they are made to.
When, I asked, would that happen?
The professor spun his antique globe and answered merely, Dr. Schwann's lecture continues tomorrow.
It must have taken courage to return.
Not really. An enforcer escorted me, so at least no one flung insults at me. The enforcer addressed the second row of girls with courteous malice.
This is our row. Go to the back.
The girls melted away, but I felt no triumph. It was the girls' fear of unanimity, not their acceptance of me, that prevailed. Dr. Schwann was so flustered by the enforcer that she mumbled her entire lecture without once looking at her audience. Prejudice is permafrost.
Did you brave any more lectures?
One, on Lao's fundaments. By request I went unescorted, preferring insults to external armor. I arrived early, took a side seat, and kept a visor on as the lecture hall filled. I was recognized nonetheless. The students regarded me with mistrust, but no paper missiles were launched. Two boys in front turned around. They had honest faces and rural accents. One asked if I really was some sort of artificial genius. Genius is not a word to bandy so casually, I suggested. Hearing a server talk made the pair marvel. It must be hell, said the second, to have an intelligent mind trapped in a body genomed for service. I had grown as attached to my body as he had to his, I responded. The lecture proceeded without event, but when I left the hall, a small riot of questions, mic'd Walkmans and flash Nikons, was waiting for me. Which Papa Songs had I come from? Who had enrolled me at Temo-san? Were there more of me? What were my views on the Yuna 939 atrocity? How many weeks did I have before my ascension degenerated? Was I an abolitionist? What was my favorite color? Did I have a boyfriend?
Media? On a corporocratic campus?
No, but media had offered rewards for features on the Sanmi of Temo-san. I hooded and tried to elbow my way back to the unanimity faculty, but the crush was so thick my visor was knocked off, and I was floored and badly bruised before two plainclothes enforcers could extricate me. Boardman Mephi met me in the unanimity lobby and escorted me back to my quarters, muttering that I was too valuable to expose myself to the prurient mob. He rotated his rainstone ring vigorously, a habit when tense. We agreed from then on my lectures should be digied to my Sony.
What about the experiments you were obliged to undergo?
Ah, yes, a daily reminder of my true status. They depressed my spirits. What was knowledge for, I would ask myself, if I could not use it to better my existence? How would I fit in on Exaltation 9 years and 9 stars later with my superior knowledge? Could amnesiads erase the knowledge I had acquired? Did I want that to happen? Would I be happier? 4th month arrived, bringing my first anniversary as a specimen freak on Temo-san. But spring did not bring me the gladness it brings the world. My curiosity is dying, I told Professor Mephi one pleasant day, during a seminar on Thomas Paine. I remember the sounds of a baseball game drifting through his open window. My mentor said we had to identify the source of this malady, and urgently. I said something about reading not being knowledge, about knowledge without experience being food without sustenance.
You need to get out more, remarked the professor.
Out where? Out to lectures? Out on the campus? Outings?
Next 9th night, a young unanimity postgrad named Heiju Im elevated to my apartment. Addressing me as Miss Sonmi, he explained that Professor Mephi had asked him to come and cheer you up. Professor Mephi held the power of life and death over his future, he said, so here he was.
That was a joke, he added edgily.
Then he asked if I remembered him. I did. His black hair was crew-cut maroon now, and his eyebrows on-offed where they had been unadorned. But I recognized Boom Sook's ex-classmate, who had brought the news of Wing 027's death at the hands of Min Sik. My visitor looked around my living space enviously. "Well, this beats Boom Sook Kim's pokey nest, doesn't it? Big enough to swallow my family's entire apartment." I agreed. The apartment was very spacious indeed. A silence inflated. Heiju Im offered to stay inside the elevator until I wanted him to leave. Once again, I apologized for my lack of social grace and invited him in. He took his Nikes off, saying, "No, I apologize for my lack of social grace. I talk too much when I get nervous and say stupid things. Here I go again. Can I try out your maglev chaise long?" "Yes," I said, and asked why I made him nervous. "I looked like any sonmi in any old diner," he answered. "But when I opened my mouth, I became a doctor of philosophy." The post-grad sat cross-legged on the chaise long and swung, wonderingly, passing his hand through the magnetic field. He confessed, "A little voice in my head is saying, 'Remember this girl, woman, I mean person, is a landmark in the history of science. The first stable ascendant, rather. Watch what you say, Im. Make it profound.' That's why I'm just, spouting rubbishy nothings." I assured him I felt more like a specimen than like a landmark. Heiju shrugged and told me the professor had said I could use a night out downtown, and he waved a soul ring. "Unanimity expenses. Sky's the limit. So what's your idea of fun?" I had no idea of fun. "Well," Heiju probed, "what did I do to relax?" "I play Go against my Sony," I said. "To relax?" he responded, incredulous. "Who wins, you or the Sony?" "The Sony," I answered, "or how would I ever improve?" "So winners," Heiju proposed, "are the real losers because they learn nothing? What, then, are losers? Winners?" I said, "If losers can exploit what their adversaries teach them, yes, losers can become winners in the long term." "Sweet corpocracy," Heiju Im puffed. "Let's go downtown and spend some dollars." "Didn't he irritate you a little?" Initially, he irritated me a lot, but I reminded myself that he was Professor Meffi's prescription for my malaise. Also, Heiju had paid me the compliment of referring to me as a person. I asked him what he normally did on ninth nights, when not coerced into looking after prize specimens. He told me with a diplomatic lowered smile how men of Meffi's stratum never coerce, only imply. He might go to a dinery or bar with classmates, or, if he lucked out, go clubbing with a girl. I was not a classmate and not exactly a girl, so he suggested a galleria to sample the fruits of Neos or Kopros. "Would he not be embarrassed," I asked, "to be seen with a sonmi? I could wear a hat and wraparounds." Heiju Im instead proposed a stick-on wizardly beard and a pair of reindeer antlers. I apologized. I had none. The young man smiled, apologized for another stupid joke, and told me to wear whatever I felt comfortable in, assuring me that I would blend in much better downtown than in a lecture hall. A taxi was downstairs, and he would wait for me in the lobby. "Were you nervous about leaving Temo-san?" "Slightly, yes. Heiju distracted me by sightseeing talk. He directed the taxi via the memorial to the fallen plutocrats, around Kyong Bokung Palace, down the avenue of 9,000 Advis. The driver was a pure-blood Indian with a sharp nose for fat fares from expense accounts. 'An ideal night for Moon Tower, sir,' he happened to mention. 'Very clear.' Heiju agreed on the spot. The helterway ascended the gigantic pyramid, high, high, high above the canopies, above everything except the corp monoliths. 'Have you been up Moon Tower by night, archivist?' 'No, not even by day. We citizens leave the tower for the tourists, mostly.' 'You should go. From the 234th story, the conurb was a carpet of xenon and neon, and motion and carbdioxide and canopies. But for the glass dome, Heiju told me the wind at this altitude would fling us into orbit like satellites. He indicated various humpbacks and landmarks, some I had heard of or seen on 3D, some not. Changmyo Plaza was hidden behind a monolith, but its day-blue stadium was visible. Seed Corp was the lunar sponsor that night. The immense lunar projector on far-off Fuji beamed ADV after ADV onto the moon's face. Tomatoes big as babies, creamy cauliflower cubes, holeless lotus roots. Speech bubbles ballooned from Seed Corp's logo man's juicy mouth, guaranteeing that his products were 100% genomically modified. Descending, the elderly taxi driver spoke of his boyhood in a distant conurb called Mubai, now deadlanded, when the moon was always naked. Heiju said an Advilus moon would freak him out.
Which gallery did you go to?
Wang Shimni Orchard. What an encyclopedia of consumables. For hours I pointed at items for Heiju to identify. Bronze masks, instant bird's nest soup, fabricant toys, golden Suzukis, air filters, acid-proof skeins, oraculars of the beloved chairman, and statuettes of the imminent chairman, jewel powder perfumes, pearl silk scarves, real-time maps, deadland artifacts, programmable violins, a pharmacy, packets of pills for cancer, AIDS, Alzheimer's, lead tox, for corpulence, anorexia, baldness, hairiness, exuberance, glumness, do drugs, drugs for overindulgence and do drugs. Hour 21 chimed, yet we had not advanced beyond a single precinct. How the consumers seethed to buy, buy, buy. Purebloods, it seemed, were a sponge of demand that sucked goods and services from every vendor, dinery, bar, shop, and nook. Heiju led me to a stylish cafe platform, where he bought a styro of Starbucks for himself and an aqua for me. He explained that under the enrichment statutes, consumers have to spend a fixed quota of dollars each month, depending on their strata. Hoarding is an anti-corporocratic crime. I knew this already, but did not interrupt. He said his mum feels intimidated by modern gallerias, so Heiju usually works through the quota. I asked him to tell me how it feels to be in a family. The postgrad smiled and frowned at the same time. A necessary drag, he confided. Mum's hobby is collecting minor ailments and drugs to cure them. Dad works at the Ministry of Statistics and sleeps in front of 3D with his head in a bucket. Both parents were random conceptions, he confessed, who sold a second child quota to get Heiju genomed properly. This let him aim for his cherished career. To be a unanimity man had been his ambition since the Disneys of his boyhood. Kicking down doors for money looked like a fine life. His parents must love him very much to make such a sacrifice, I noted. Heiju replied that their pension will come out of his salary. Then he asked, had it not been a seismic shock to be uprooted from Papa Song's and transplanted into Boom Suk's lab? Didn't I miss the world I had been genomed for? I answered, fabricants are oriented not to miss things. He probed, had I not ascended above my orientation? I said I would have to think about it.
Did you experience any negative reactions from consumers in the Galleria? As a sonmi outside Papa Song's, I mean.
No. Many other fabricants were there. Porters, domestics, and cleaners, so I did not stand out so much. Then when Heiju went to the hygiener, a ruby-freckled woman with a teenage complexion but telltale older eyes apologized for disturbing me. "Look, I'm a media fashion scout," she said. "Call me Lily. I've been spying on you." And she giggled. "But that's what a woman of your flair, your prescience, my dear, must expect." I was very confused. She said I was the first consumer she'd seen to facecape fully, like a well-known service fabricant. Lesser strata, she confided, may call my fashion statement brave, or even anti-strata, but she called it genius. She asked if I would like to model for an abhorrently chic 3D magazine. I'd be paid stratospherically, she assured me. My boyfriend's friends would crawl with jealousy. And for us women, she added, jealousy in our men is as good as dollars in the soul. I declined, thanking her and adding that fabricants do not have boyfriends. The media woman pretended to laugh at my imagined joke and examined every contour on my face. She begged to know which faithscaper had done me. A craftsman like this I have got to meet, such a miniaturist. After my womb tank and orientation, I said, my life had been spent behind a counter at Papa Song's, and so I had never met my faithscaper. Now the fashion editor's laugh was droll, but vexed. So she couldn't believe you weren't a pureblood. She gave me her card and urged me to reconsider, warning that opportunities like her do not happen 10 days a week. When the taxi dropped me at Unanimity, Heiju Im asked me to use his given name from then on. Mr. Im made him feel like he was in a seminar. Lastly, he asked if I might be free next 9th day. I did not want him to spend his valuable time on a professorial obligation, I said, but Heiju insisted he had enjoyed my company. I said, well then, I accept. So the excursion helped dislodge your sense of ennui? In a way, yes. It helped me understand how one's environment is a key to one's identity, but that my environment, Papa Song's, was a lost key. I found myself wishing to revisit my ex-dinery under Changmyo Plaza. I could not fully explain why, but an impulse can be both vaguely understood and strong.
It could hardly be wise for an ascended server to visit a dinery.
I do not claim it was wise, only necessary. Heiju also worried that it might unearth buried things. I responded that I had buried too much of myself, so the postgrad agreed to accompany me, on the condition that I went disguised as a consumer. The following 9th night, he showed me how to upswirl my hair and apply cosmetics. A silk neck scarf hid my collar, and in the elevator down to the taxi, he fitted dark ambers on my face. On a busy 4th month evening, Changmyo Plaza was not the litter-swarming wind tunnel I remembered from my release. It was a kaleidoscope of advies, consumers, execs, and pop songs. Beloved chairman's monumental statue surveyed his swarming peoples, with an expression wise and benign. From the plaza's southeast rim, Papa Song's arches drew into focus. Heiju held my hand and reminded me we could turn back at any time. As we got in line for the elevator, he slipped a soul ring onto my finger.
In case you got separated?
For good luck, I thought. Heiju had a superstitious streak. As the elevator descended, I grew very nervous. Suddenly the doors were opening and hungry consumers riptided me into the dinery. As I was jostled, I was stunned at how misleading my memories of the place had been.
In what ways?
That spacious dome was so pokey, its glorious reds and yellows so stark and vulgar. The wholesome air I remembered, now its greasy stench gagged me. After the silence on Temo-san, the dinery noise was like never-ending gunfire. Papa Song stood on his plinth, greeting us. I tried to swallow, but my throat was dry. Surely my logo man would condemn his prodigal daughter. No. He winked at us, tugged himself skyward by his own Nike straps, sneezed, oopsied, and plummeted down to his plinth. Children screamed with laughter. I realized Papa Song was just a trick of lights. How had an inane hologram once inspired such awe in me? Heiju went to find a table while I circumed the hub. My sisters smiled under sugary top lights. How unflaggingly they worked. Here were Yuna's. Here was Ma Lu Da 108, her collar now boasting 11 stars. At my old counter on West was a fresh-faced Sonmi. Here was Kailim 889, Yuna's replacement. I got in line at her teller, my nervousness growing acute as my turn approached. "Hi, Kailim 889 at your service. Mouth-watering, magical Papa Songs. Yes, madam, your pleasure today?" I asked her if she knew me.
Kailim 889 smiled extra to dilute her confusion. I asked her if she remembered Sonmi 451, a server who worked beside her, who disappeared one morning. A blank smile. The verb remember is outside service lexicons.
Hi, Kailim 889 at your service. Mouth-watering, magical, papa songs. Your pleasure today?
I asked, are you happy, Kailim 889? Enthusiasm lit her smile as she nodded. Happy is a word in the second catechism. Proviso, I obey the catechisms. Papa song loves me. Proviso, papa song loves me. I am happy. A cruel compulsion brushed me. I asked the Kailim, didn't she want to live how purebloods live? Sit at dinery tables instead of wiping them. Kailim 889 wanted so badly to please, telling me, servers eat soap. Yes, I persisted, but didn't she want to see outside? She said, servers don't go outside until 12 starred. A consumer girl with sink ringlets and plectrum nails jabbed me. If you've got to taunt dumb fabricants, do it on first day mornings. I need to get to the Gallerias this side of curfew, okay? Hastily I ordered rose juice and shark gums from Kailim 889. I wished Heiju was still with me. I was jumpy in case the soul ring malfunctioned and exposed me. The device worked, but my questions had marked me as a troublemaker. Democratize your own fabricants. A man glowered as I pushed by with my tray. Abolitionist. Other purebloods in the line glanced at me, worried as if I carried a disease. Heiju had found a free table in my old quarter. How many tens of thousands of times had I wiped this surface? Heiju asked gently if I had discovered anything valuable. I whispered, "We are just slaves here for 12 years." The unanimity postgrad just scratched his ear and checked no one was eavesdropping, but his expression told me he agreed. He sipped his rose juice. We watched Advi for 10 minutes, not speaking. A Jewish boardman was shown opening a newer, safer nuclear reactor, grinning as if his strata depended on it. Kailim 889 cleared the table next to us. She had already forgotten me. My IQ may be higher, but she looked more content than I felt.
So your visit to Papa Song's was an anti-climax? Did you find the key to your ascended self?
Perhaps it was anticlimactic, yes. If there was a key, it was only that no key existed. In Papa Song's, I had been a slave. At Temo-san, I was a more privileged slave. One more thing occurred, however, as we headed back to the elevator. I recognized Mrs. Ree, working at her Sony. I spoke her name out loud. The immaculately dew-drugged woman smiled up with puzzled, luscious, remodeled lips. I was Mrs. Ree, but I am Mrs. An now. My late husband drowned in a sea-fishing accident last year. I said that was just awful. Mrs. An dabbed her eye with her sleeve and asked if I had known her late husband well. Lying is harder than purebloods make it look, and Mrs. An repeated her question.
My wife was a quality standardizer for the corp before our marriage, Heiju explained hastily, putting his hand on my shoulder and adding that Changmyo Plaza was in her area and that Seo Ri had been an exemplary corp man. Mrs. An's suspicions were aroused, however, and she asked exactly when that might have been. Now I knew what to say. When his chief aide was a consumer named Cho. Her smile changed its hue.
Ah, yes, aide Cho. Sent north somewhere, I believe, to learn about team spirit. Heiju took my arm, saying,
Well, all for Papa Song for all. The gallery is beckon, darling. Mrs. An is obviously a woman with no time to fritter.
Later, back in my quiet apartment, Heiju paid me this compliment.
If I had ascended from server to prodigy in 12 straight months, my current address wouldn't be a guest quarter in the unanimity faculty. I would be in a psych ward somewhere, seriously. These existential qualms you suffer, they just mean you're truly human.
I asked how I might remedy them.
You don't remedy them. You live through them.
We played Go until curfew. Heiju won the first game, I the second.
How many of these excursions took place?
Every ninth night until Corpocracy Day. Familiarity bred esteem for Heiju, and soon I shared Boardman Meffi's high opinion of him. The professor never probed about our outings during our seminars. His protege probably filed reports, but Meffi wished me to have at least the illusion of a private life. Board business demanded more of his time, and I saw him less regularly. The morning tests continued, a procession of courteous but unmemorable scientists. Heiju had a unanimity man's fondness for campus intrigue. I learned how Taemo-san was no united organism, but a hillock of warring tribes and interest groups, much like the douche itself. The unanimity faculty maintained a despised dominance. Secrets are magic bullets, Heiju was fond of saying. But this dominance also explains why trainee enforcers have few friends outside the faculty. Girls looking for husbands, Heiju admitted, were attracted to his future status, but males of his own age eschewed getting drunk in his company. Archivist, my appointment in the lighthouse is approaching. Can we segue to my final night on campus?
Please do.
A keen passion of Heiju's was Disney's, and one perk of Professor Meffi's mentorship was access to forbidden items in the security archives.
You mean Union Samizdat from the production zones?
No, I mean a zone even more forbidden. The past. Before the skirmishes. Disney's were called movies in those days. Heiju said the ancients had an artistry that 3D and corpocracy had long obsolesced. As the only Disneys I had ever seen were Boom Sook's porn splatters, I was obliged to believe him. On 6 months' final ninth night, Heiju arrived with a key to a Disneyarium on campus, explaining that a pretty media student was currying favor with him. He spoke in a theatrical whisper, "I've got a disc of seriously one of the greatest movies ever made by any director from any age."
Namely,
a picaresque entitled The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish, made before the foundation of Neosokopros, in a long, dead-landed province of the European democracy. Have you ever seen film dating from the early 21st century, archivist?
Sweet Corpocracy, no. An eighth-stratum archivist wouldn't get such security clearance in his wildest dreams. I'd be fired for even applying, and I'm shocked that even a unanimity post-grad has access to such deviational material.
Is that so? Well, the Jewish's stance on historical discourse is riddled with inconsistencies. On the one hand, if historical discourse were permitted, the downstrata could access a bank of human experience that would rival and sometimes contradict that taught by media. On the other hand, corpocracy funds your ministry of archivism, dedicated to preserving a historical record for future ages.
Yes. But our existence is kept from the downstrata.
Except from those condemned to the lighthouse.
Be that as it may, future ages will still be corpocratic ones. Corpocracy isn't just another political system that will come and go. Corpocracy is the natural order, in harmony with human nature. But we're digressing. Why had Heiju Im chosen to show you this ghastly ordeal?
Perhaps Professor Meffi had instructed him. Perhaps Heiju Im had no reason except a fondness for the Disney. Whatever the reason, I was engrossed. The past is a world both indescribably different from and yet subtly similar to Neosokopros. People sagged and uglified as they aged in those days. No do drugs. Elderly purebloods waited to die in prisons for the senile. No fixed-term lifespans, no euthanasium. Dollars circulated as little sheets of paper, and the only fabricants were sickly livestock. However, corpocracy was emerging, and social strata was demarked, based on dollars and, curiously, the quantity of melanin in one's skin.
I can tell how fascinated you were.
Certainly. The vacant Disneyarium was a haunting frame for those lost, rainy landscapes.
Giants strode the screen, lit by sunlight captured through a lens, when your grandfather's grandfather, archivist, was kicking in his natural womb. Time is the speed at which the past decays, but Disney's enable a brief resurrection. Those since fallen buildings